Well, I'm looking at the opposite problem to Doug Mosley. I want to make sure people don't get sick in the first place rather than try to cure them afterwards. So this is a description of some work we did together with two of my graduate students, or former graduate students, and a design engineer from Siemens Electronic, their plant down in Chatham. And they were building sensors for airbags. And the problem in airbag is that you have this bag, you got to send it a signal, and that signal got to tell where you're hitting the brakes hard or you're hitting the concrete wall. In other words, you want it to be sensitive enough that if you have an accident, the airbag comes up and prevents you from being injured, but not so sensitive that it keeps on coming up, because if the airbag goes off, it has to be replaced. So it is a non-trivial problem, and expensive too if it's too sensitive. The people I've worked with were working for General Motors, so of course they told the stories about Chrysler, and one of the main stories they told was an elderly couple down in Detroit going to a showroom for one of the big Chrysler cars, and the wife is sitting inside the front wheel and admiring the nice interior. Husband is outside. They open up the hood so you can have a look at the motor, slam the hood down, and up comes the airbag. It is not a good sales technique. On the other hand, Buick claimed they have two medium-sized Buick and head-on collision, 50 miles each, and one of the drivers had to be helped over to the, walked over to the ambulance. The other one walked by himself. And it's not really designed for that, but that's the story they quote. Okay, so that's the main problem. You've got to send a signal if the car crashes, and not if you're just doing some hard braking. If you look at the requirements on them, just to give an idea of the engineering type problem, you've got to work between roughly minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, Alaska, to plus 120, Arizona. And it got to work up to 10 years. And got to work very quickly, 10 milliseconds thereabouts. An airbag got to come out before the body starts moving forward. You don't want people to go forward and then slam them back. So it got to come out just at the right time. And of course, since you mainly talk about mere conditions for this project here, people are going to sue you if it doesn't work, if it works too quickly. A woman in California sued General Motors because she had a collision. The airbag came up. She was not really hurt. But when it came up, it went past her cheek and gave her a bit of rope burn on her cheek, and she sued them. So that's the other problem. The final thing, problem on the conveyor airbags and sensors is that you can't really test them. You can't go and check your airbag and see if it works. If it works, you remove it. So this piece of equipment got to sit there, and got to sit there indefinitely, almost, at least 10 years. I was going to make up a slide, but I forgot. The way they usually set up the sensors is that if one assumes this is the front end of the car, you'll have a main sensor sitting here in the middle, and two sensors at a bit of an angle, one on each side. And usually the system is set up so you got to get a positive signal for at least two out of the three sensors before the airbag goes up. Okay, what kind of sensors? Well, they looked at many different designs, and the one I worked on was a mechanical one, and it basically a ball bearing sitting inside a tube, a constant magnet holds it back, and in the other end down here, there are two spring electrodes sticking out. And the argument, of course, is that when the car stops, if it stops too abruptly, the airbag will break the grip of the magnet and roll down, close the gap between the two electrodes, and off you get a signal. So there are a couple of things one got to think about. First of all, how long does it take to come down here? Secondly, does it stay in contact long enough? Is the dwell time long enough that you got a proper signal sent off? If one looks at it, the ball bearing is gold-coated. I didn't know there were companies that would deliver gold-coated ball bearings if you ask for them. You got to buy a lot to get them cheap enough. The diagram is not in scale. The gap there is very small. What is governing the time it takes for the whole thing to move is not only the strength of the magnet, the weight of the ball bearing, but also a little gap. In other words, it's a gas flow problem. And that is an important part of it. And to give you an idea of the length of it, I used to have an example of these sensors, but I've been to too many talks, and when you let them out and the people have a look at them, eventually you don't get them back. So I haven't got it. Anyway, the cylinder is about 2 centimeters. Ball mass is about 5.7 gram. Radius about half a centimeter. And it travels about 1 centimeter. And there's roughly the gap we're talking about. So when they are putting the whole thing together, they do it in a clean room. You can't have too much dust rolling around in it. And the question now is, how are we going to solve this problem? Well, if you look at a force balance, it's clear that F is equal to ma, and we've got a magnetic force, we've got a drag force, a friction force, because we either got rolling friction or sliding friction, and we've got a spring force. The spring force is mainly important to decide where you got the ball stays in contact long enough, the dwell time. Now the question is, how are we going to solve this problem? And if you look at what the engineers require, they want to have something they can sit and experiment with. In other words, what happens if our ball bearings are not quite up the accuracy we saw? They were a little bit less, a little bit more. What will it do to the time it takes for the ball to reach the electric contact? And what does it do for the dwell time? On top of that, they also want a package that's easy to use, and you should be able to do a run in no more than 30 seconds. We want to sit and play and things like that. Okay, one way of doing it, if one was an academic and had infinite amount of time and no problems or anything, would be, of course, to think of, okay, I'll solve the Maxwell equation to get the magnetic force. Then I'll solve the compressible Navier-Stokes equation for the damping force, shove the whole thing in, do something about the contact force and the spring force, and solve the whole problem. And there's a slight problem with that. This gentleman here used a nice expression that one uses in business, i.e., one has got budget, time, so on. I put it differently. They gave us 2 months and $10,000. Do it. Now, I was wondering about the 2 months I asked them, and it turned out that they were a parts manufacturer. And the car manufacturer, in this case mainly General Motors, wanted to see some research done on the premises. So when I got there, they said, well, if we give you a check for $10,000, can you give us a receipt? I said, fine, but don't you want to see a proposal? Well, you can do that afterwards. It turned out that General Motors are coming next week, and they had to show them something. So that's the only time I've really been asked to take the money first and we worry about what the hell one is going to do afterwards.
Take the money and run?
It wasn't enough. Another zero on it, I would have been tempted. Okay, so it was clear that with those constraints, I was not going to solve the compressible Navier-Stokes equation in the tube. And secondly, it was not necessary. That's not the accuracy we're talking to. We're going to do a lot of calibration anyway. So what we did was we started looking at an approximate form, something we could put into a shape where we could actually solve it and get a nice package. First thing we said, well, and they gave us the measurements, we assumed that the magnetic force varies linearly with X0 being the magnet running down the center of the tube. And they'll give us F0 and F1 from their different permanent magnets. They had several different kinds. The drag force, well, we're saying it's undoubtedly due to P2 minus P1 times pi r squared, r being the radius, and P2 being pressure on the magnet side and P1 being pressure on the other side. There's some nice mathematics in the end to get expressions for P1 and P2, but I'll come to it in a second. The spring force, that's just giving. The spring force, again, I'll say it varies linearly with X. It's a fairly weak spring, and so it was just a question of getting the measurements again. There it turned out that S0 and S1 were quite important. They had trouble getting springs that had the same characteristics all the time. Remember, we were talking about making 300,000-400,000 a year in the beginning and then crank it up to about 1 million a year. If you start ordering springs at that, or even the magnets had trouble too, it was not that easy to make sure that these were all the same thing over a 6 month period. And that was one of the reasons they wanted this package, because they want to know that if you get a new set of springs, a new set of magnets in, you'll do the measurements, you'll shove it into your model, in this computer model, and see if the response is still within the tolerance required by the company. I was also told that you don't talk about General Motors, you talk about the company. You don't talk about a car, you talk about a platform. And you especially don't mention the name of the car you're talking about. That was not accepted. Friction force, you'll assume it's get a form like that. If you shove all that together, one can write it down as four equations. Q being the velocity, P1 the pressure on one side, capital V1 being the volume of air on the side, and M being the mass of air. W is the total mass flow, and in the end we had to find an approximate expression relating the total mass flow, W, and P1 and P2. So we get four equations, four unknowns. And if anybody wants to see them, I got a copy of the paper. I didn't bother writing it all down. Quite messy. And the first thing, of course, people thought about is any possibility of an analytic solution. And we didn't really follow it up, but I'm fairly sure there's not.
So you
keep it in the initial value problem? Yeah. X equals zero. We start at the beginning, and we assume that all the air is on the right-hand side, so to speak, of the ball bearing. So everything starts at zero, and we're just rolling down. And the question now really is, oh, to give you an idea of what X is. Yes, we assume that for the flow of the air, we assume that we could approximate it by a steady, like we're dropping a ball bearing in a tube. And we're just looking at it as a steady state problem. We assume that the ideal gas flow will hold for the gas, in this case the air. And we got fairly close to the experiments. Surprisingly close, in fact. I was a bit worried for a while that we were going to be way off. X is just, could just be expressed in terms of the volume. And typical results. The way the whole problem was set up was that they had a test rig where they could kind of simulate the motion of the sensor. So our analytics or approximate or numerical results had to go along with that. So that's the reason that the ball doesn't start moving at T equals zero. There's a little bit of a lag there. The ball closes at 0.008 seconds, which is within about 5% of what the measurements was. These are for a particular set of physical parameters of the problem. And the dwell time it stays on for quite a while, definitely long enough. So that showed that our model was not completely crazy. The next question, of course, was that could it be made useful? And If you look at this, here's the gap and the closing times. And the gap is in percentages, so one is the case you just looked at. So I'm taking it as proportional to that. And you can see that if the gap is too small, the air can't get back around the ball bearing, and it never reaches the end, i.e. the airbag won't go off. And there you can see that the as we increase the gap, we get shorter and shorter time down to the end there. So that was one of the things, and the question now, of course, is that one could see that if they would open up the conditions, i.e., the time to closing could kind of vary between 4% less and 16% more, we could then buy cheaper ball bearings because the accuracy wouldn't have to be as serious. It was that type of question they want to be able to have answered. What happened if we get a new shipment in of not quite the same thing? Rather than do the experiments, they wanted something that could give them indication at least before they start doing the experiments. The other thing, of course, is that what happened as the car hits, what kind of force do we need to set it off? And again, this one is the first case I talked about, the one to use to calibrate against measurements. And one can see there that point one, the ball bearing doesn't move, and so on. And there you can see that as the force becomes increases, the time to closure decreases, as one would expect. And again, the times they got here are in agreement with what they found. Now, the problem is that it was hard to get really good results except from the test rig, because any other way you do it is to take a car and slam it into a concrete wall and see what happens. And they didn't really want to do that too often. So most of the testing was done on a test rig. And then after they'd done all that, they then sent it out in the field and see what happened. They had problems with one of their cars because they found that it was more of a blow coming in from the side, let's say about 35 degrees, it looked like the ball bearing started shaking back and forth and never reached the contact, i.e. the airbag didn't go off. They were not very happy for a while over that one. To give you an idea of how one did the mathematics, here are the assumptions. Remember I was saying that we need an expression between the total mass flow and the pressure difference between the on either side of the ball bearing. And I assumed here we had a non-rotating sphere that moved along the axis of a closely fitting infinite cylinder fit there, a gap much smaller than the radius, and steady state. The reason for that, of course, was that then I could start talking about lubrication theory, and life becomes a lot, if not easier, at least possible. And one started looking at pictures like this. And in fact, it turned out to be quite a nice exercise in looking at that problem there. It turned out that people had looked at it earlier on. However, all this thing here is based on steady state flow. I did not look at the case where I have an impulsively started closely fitting ball bearing. If anybody want to look at it, it's really messy. Even this thing here was quite fun. If one uses lubrications here using that notation up there, one ends up with a problem like that, and one can do a whole lot of stuff with it. And again, I got a copy of the paper, and if anybody's interested, they can see all the details. And what we get is that U is from that. From this, we can get an equation for capital P, the pressure. And we couldn't solve it. So we sat there for a while and looked at it until, of course, I remembered the fact that I did an engineering degree first time around, and we did dimensional analysis. So if you do that and make some reasonable assumptions about the different quantities, you can show in the end that this term here can be ignored, to at least a reasonable level of accuracy. And then, of course, it's a trivial problem to integrate. The referee, when we wrote the paper, had a few complaints about it, but in the end, we convinced him that it was reasonable. And you get a total, an approximation at least, to the total flow rate, W, in terms of P1 squared minus P2 squared. Given that, you can substitute back in. But it took us a bit more than the 2 months to get over this part here, because we didn't really know how to do it. So what can one say we learned from that? Well, one of the main problems I found here was that before, especially if you're doing industrial problems, one should always consider how much money is available, i.e. it's easy enough to make big plans on how to solve the problem completely. However, if you've got a certain time frame and certain amount of money, what is the best you can do? Secondly, we also realized that talking to engineers, one should get a good idea out of engineers what kind of accuracy they really want. And it's clear in a problem like this, trying to solve a compressible Navier-Stokes equation would be completely silly. It's not required. We can get a lot. One can get 95% without doing that. With respect to computer algebra and MAPLE, since David insisted I mention something about it at least, how could one use it? Well, it's clear it would have been nice to have had a way of doing a prototyping to get out. Would something like MAPLE be sufficient for the engineers? No, I don't think so. The main reason was that the first version of the program we showed the engineers, the input parameters are sitting in a file, and you use an editor to change the file. And they put up with it. Second time around, it was kind of a little bit easier, a kind of file that appeared on the screen, and you could go and change it. They quite liked that. Third time around, I got an undergraduate student to write an interface, so you can kind of highlight the density or the size of the ball bearing and change that, and they really loved that. And the argument was that somebody's going to use this program for a couple of days, maybe once a month. They want something that they can use now. They don't want to spend an hour trying to remember how they did it last time. And as far as I know, at least not, I haven't looked at MAPLE 8, but the earlier version, as far as I know, it's not easy to set up a proper user interface in MAPLE. Am I still correct?
I'll send you MAPLE in the next talk.
Okay. But anyway, it was clear that for the engineers, if you want to get money for some of the stuff, user interface is very important, far more important than we really think that it is in universities. We are used to graduate students and so on being told, go spend a couple of days and figure out how to use the program. I got the strong feeling with this party and several others we did that in industry they won't put up with that. So, thank you.